This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross.
I have returned to announce my candidacy to be the next president of the United States.
Alan Alda joins the West Wing. A new challenger.
Got a situation.
And what timing?
I can't move.
What a season. All new West Wing, NBC next Wednesday.
Alan Alda, after years of hosting PBS science shows and adopting a fairly low profile, is playing senators in two current high-profile Hollywood projects. On TV's The West Wing, he plays a noble and principled senator, a California Republican named Arnold, with eyes on the presidency. In the movie The Aviator, directed by Martin Scorsese, Alda plays a ruthless senator. The film, which stars Leonardo DiCaprio as Howard Hughes, is Alda's first movie role in 3 years. Alda is most famous and celebrated for playing Hawkeye Pierce, the pacifistic Korean War doctor in the long-running CBS sitcom MASH. That show's final episode remains the most-watched entertainment program in TV history. Alda is the only person to win Emmys for acting, directing, and writing. After MASH, he starred in The Four Seasons, Sweet Liberty, The Seduction of Joe Tynan, and Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors and Manhattan Murder Mystery. His recent films include Flirting with Disaster and the Woody Allen musical Everyone Says I Love You. Terry spoke with Alda in 1997 when that film was released. Here's Alda singing in that film.
Looking at you while troubles are fleeing, I'm admiring the view. 'Cause it's you I'm seeing, and the sweet honeydew of well-being settles upon me. What is this light that shines when you enter like a star in the night? And what's to prevent her from destroying my sight if you center all of it on me? Looking at you, I'm filled with the essence of, the quintessence of joy. Looking at you, I hear poets telling of lovely Helen of Troy. Darling, life seems so.
That's Alan Alda from the soundtrack of Woody Allen's film Everyone Says I Love You. How did you start working with Woody Allen?
I worked with Woody for the first time, I think, about 30 years ago on a pilot that he wrote, and I had a relatively small part in it. And it was about a troupe of improvising actors, and I had been an improviser. And I think it's one of the things that makes me enjoy working in his films is that I enjoy improvising, and he wants the actors to improvise. And we had after that pilot, we ran into each other every once in a while. But I didn't actually work with him again until Crimes and Misdemeanors, when he just sent me a letter and asked me if I wanted to be in the movie.
I thought it was so clever of him to cast you as, you know, this vain, self-absorbed producer, because you had had this image for so long as, you know, like Mr. Feminist, Mr. Sensitive. And it was such a wonderful turn for you.
You know what's funny about that I think the last 6 or 8 movies I've been in, I've played either the bad guy or somebody who does kind of reprehensible things, and everybody always says, "Boy, this picture is such a departure." You know, I must have made such an impression the other way that every time, no matter how many times I do the other thing, people are going to think it's a departure.
Let me ask you a few questions about MASH. What were your first impressions of the script?
I thought it was an extremely good pilot. I was in the Utah State Prison at the time.
And filming a movie.
Yes. I was trying to work on the image there a little bit. I was shooting a movie for about 3 weeks in the Utah State Prison, and they sent me the script of MASH, and it was the best script I had read while I was in prison, certainly, but it was also the best script of any television show I'd ever seen, I think. Larry Gelbart had written it, and it was really sharp, you know. But I was concerned that what would I was concerned about what would happen after the show went into production. I didn't know if Larry would be part of it, and I was worried that it would become hijinks at the front, and that the war would just sort of exist as a pretext for silly stories. And in fact, some of the early scripts done by freelance writers who didn't know what the possibilities were and were sure that on television you don't go for anything substantive, wrote, in essence, McHale's Navy in Korea, you know, on McHale's Navy on the ground. And it really scared me at that point. By then we had already had an agreement, because before I agreed to do the show, I had a midnight meeting with Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds, who were producing the show, and we all agreed that we wanted to do a show in which the war was seen for what it is, as a, you know, a place where people are badly hurt, and the humor came out of the reaction to that. The humor came out of the crazy pressure everybody was put under.
Now, I want to ask you about your formative years. You grew up in show business. Your father was Robert Alda, who, among other things, originated the role of Skye Masterson in the Broadway production of Guys and Dolls, played George Gershwin in the 1945 film Rhapsody in Blue. What was he doing before the movies when you were a young boy?
Well, when I was born, he was in burlesque, and I spent the first 3 years of my life standing in the wings watching strippers and comics and chorus girls, and It was a bizarre beginning to a life. Most of the questions you asked me today can be answered by that, I think.
What did you make of it as a very young boy watching strippers? Did you have any idea what that was about?
I didn't. I do remember. You know, children are so much more aware than everybody gives them credit for. I remember thinking, because when the chorus girls would take me up to their dressing room, you know, they would take me up and they would comb my hair and talk to me, and I was like a mascot, like a little pet. And then they'd say, okay, Allie, we're going to change our clothes now, turn your back, and I'd stand with my face pressed against their costumes hanging on the wall, and I'd smell the perfume, and I'd hear them behind me. And I remember thinking, they don't think this means anything to me. You know, but this is really interesting. It had to have a tremendous impact on me. It was a very unusual beginning to a life.
Do you remember the most impressive striptease act from that period?
No, I have I've interviewed people, strippers and comics from that period, because I was thinking of writing about it, and I heard some really interesting stories. There was a woman who stripped with a snake, and another woman who stripped with a bird, trained birds, and the birds would take her clothes off. But the one with the snake was really a weird. And there was another one who stripped with a swan. She did a dance called Lita and the Swan. She said, "Well, I got another booking in Philadelphia. Me and the Duck." They all had to have a gimmick, as they said in the song in the musical Gypsy. And some of them, the gimmick was just that they would go as far as they could go. And usually on closing night, they would be raunchier and more naked than they had been up until then, because if the cops closed them down, they were on the road the next day anyway.
Well, growing up on the burlesque circuit, you must have grown up thinking that one of the most important things you could do is have a good gag, good jokes.
I really had a tremendous education watching the greatest comics that we had at the time: Rags Raglan, Phil Silvers, Red Buttons, Hank Henry. He was another great burlesque comic. He was my father's partner, and my father and Hank would write their own sketches. Watching them from the wings, and then later watching Sam Levine when he acted with my father in Guys and Dolls, I would stand in the wings twice a day for 2 years watching them, and I'd especially watch Sam. All of these people were a tremendous education for me. I stood on the side, and watching from the side, you see not only what their performance is, you see where it comes from, because you're only a few feet from them, and you hear the audience reaction, and you see the way they play the audience. They have the same material every day, but they play the audience in a different way, depending on what the audience gives them back. And that interaction gives you a clue into the way their brains work. I think I grew up with that interaction with the audience in my head. So when I would write for MASH, for instance, which we didn't do in front of a live audience, I would know when I wrote the comedic moment, I would know what the audience reaction was. I could hear the reaction. In most cases, that would be true. I mean, I would then, if I'd see it played in front of a live audience, I'd be happily surprised to see that I had guessed right.
I know when you were 7, you got polio. What were your early symptoms?
It seemed like a bad cold. I was in a, we were in a movie theater that night, the first night that I got it. My father worked for Warner Brothers, so we always went to the same theater on Hollywood Boulevard, the Warner's Theater, because he could get in free there. He was on a term contract and making basically nothing a week. And it was a crowded theater, and I was sitting a few rows away from them, and I was blowing my nose, honking all during the show. And on the way home, I was honking in the car, and my mother said, "Was that you? I couldn't watch the movie. Somebody was making so much noise." And we got home, and I threw up and had all these symptoms of the flu. It seemed like the flu. Next day, she recognized the fact that I probably had polio. She had been reading in the newspapers and in magazines about the symptoms, and she saved my life because she had a doctor there within, you know, by the next morning a doctor was there. And by that time my neck was stiff already. And, you know, your muscles just contract. And the other woman who saved my life was Elizabeth Kenny, the nurse, although I never met her. She was a nurse in Africa, Sister Kenny, who discovered a cure, a treatment for polio. This was before there was a vaccine. And if you got it, you either died of it or you were paralyzed, until Sister Kenny realized that you could get the muscles that had contracted because of this disease, you could get them to open up again through heat and massage. And just about 2 years before I caught the disease, she was invited to come to America, and she lectured all over America, and the doctors who treated me had learned from her, I suppose, how to do her treatments.
So this heat treatment, I've seen a little bit and read a little bit about it. They would wrap your legs in, I think, very, very hot wool blankets what, boiled in water? Or
they weren't boiled. They were heated in a double boiler, so it was dry heat, so it wouldn't scald you. But
your legs weren't burned by it?
Yeah, it was actually every muscle in my body, I think maybe except my left arm, was affected. So I had to be wrapped. My whole body was wrapped up in these things. Every hour, a new hot pack. And they were practically scalding. They were really, it was a very tough thing for my parents to go through, because they had to do this every hour. And they had a 7-year-old kid who's screaming and pounding the bed in pain. You know, and I was trying to cooperate with them. I didn't want them to have to suffer. But I couldn't help it. It was very painful, but it saved my life. I have no residual effects from this. But the only residual effect I have is that the massage was so painful, because they would stretch your muscles, a little bit like taking your thumb and putting it back by your elbow. That's how painful it was. And to this day, I can't take a massage. Everybody says, "Oh, hey, we can get a massage down here, you know, we're going on vacation." And I say, "Make an appointment for me at the other end of the island. I don't want to go anywhere near it. Massages to me are torture."
If you wanted to get
information out of me, you send me to a masseuse. And I'll give names. I'll tell where they all are. You can't stand a massage.
Do you have any sense of what the impact was on you of being out of circulation for, I guess it was about 8 months while you were getting these treatments, and for being really sick? I've really met so many artists who were very sick for an extended period during their childhood.
It sounds like a good straight line, but...
Right, and they're sicker today.
Yeah, that's right.
The humor today,
I remember standing on my bed and looking out the window at my friends playing without me, and wishing I could play with them, but none of them even visited me. Only one came to visit me. But you have to realize that there was an epidemic on at that time, and even though I was no longer contagious, the parents didn't want to take the chance, and it was like the plague. It was like the time of the plague. You were a pariah. So I think I I functioned like somebody who was an outsider from that time on. There were several things that made me an outsider. One was that. Then my parents had me tutored because I needed to be tutored that year, but that seemed convenient to keep tutoring me so I could travel with them. So I didn't go to school till about the 7th or 8th grade. So I didn't know how kids worked. I didn't even know what the language was. My father was in burlesque, the burlesque comics would say, you want to beef about it? Hey, I'm beefing about this. I'm beefing about that. Beefing meant, as far as I knew, it meant arguing. So I get to this school and this kid gives me a shove and I complain to him and he says, you want to beef about it? And I said, I think beef means to argue. And I say, yes, I do want to beef about it. Pow! He gives me a shot in the head. This other guy comes over, he gives me a shot, and the people don't even know me now. They got somebody they can hit. So I didn't know how things worked. I was an outsider there. I was an outsider because I came from burlesque, and the world was divided up into entertainers and civilians. And I would look at the civilians and think that they came from another planet. So I've always been something of an outsider. I would laugh when I'd read people write about my life and who would say that I had a sheltered life and I was, you know, Mr. Ordinary, nice guy and all that stuff. I mean, I see things from a very skewed angle.
Just about everyone I've ever met who grew up in the 50s or 60s was in some production or another, high school, junior high school, summer camp of Guys and Dolls. Were you ever in a production of it?
Yeah, I was in when I was a young, out-of-work actor. Only about 6 or 7 years after I stood in the wings watching them do it every day, every week, I got a call that a little theater in Illinois was doing it. And would I come out there and do it? Did I know the show and did I know the part? And I said, of course I do. You know, when you're an out-of-work actor, you say yes to everything. Well, I'd only seen it. I hadn't learned it. I didn't know the songs really well, you know, and I didn't know the words, and they had lost their leading man and had to do it in 2 days. I had 2 days to get out there. And my hands were shaking when I got on the plane. And I didn't stop shaking until the plane. I'd never stopped shaking. I mean, I went on opening night with 2 days rehearsal. I didn't know what I was doing.
Which part was it?
Pardon me?
Which part?
I was playing my father's part.
Skye Masterson.
He's Skye Masterson. And I was out in the opening scene, and I couldn't even afford my own suit, so they loaned me a suit that had been hanging on a rack for 6 months someplace. And I kept my hands in my pockets because they were shaking so hard. And I just started nervous as I was playing with a piece of lint in my pocket. You know, and I'm out there on stage playing the scene with the mission doll. So halfway through the scene, I take my hand out of my pocket with the lint in it, and I casually look down at the lint. And it's not lint, it's a cockroach.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it was very interesting. The sight of that cockroach brought me back to reality with such a jolt that I lost all my nervousness, and I really looked at the woman I was talking to and really talked to her, and I opened my mouth and a song came out. Everything was great. I mean, I'm surprised they don't bring a cockroach on with me, every time I go on stage as a result of that.
Wow, what a thought. Now, you were going to go to med school.
Yeah.
Then became, I think, an English major. What was the turning point where you said, well, forget that, it's show business?
Well, I never really wanted to go to medical school. My father wanted me to go. He always wanted me to be a doctor.
And you were, but just on television.
Yeah, and he was finally satisfied with that. But the thing was, I agreed that I would go to a pre-med course in chemistry. At the time, I was afraid that if I did well in this chemistry course, I'd have to be a doctor, and then I'd have to touch sick people. So it really didn't, it was not in my best interest to do well in the course. And I managed to sort of sleep through the classes, and I got a 10 in the final exam.
10 out of 100?
Yeah, 10 out of 100, yeah. And the professor called me into his office, and he had this kind of stunned look on his face, and he said, why are you here? And I thought that was a better question than I've seen on any of the tests.
Do you think part of your aversion to being a doctor had to do with being sick when you were a kid?
Part of my disinclination to be a doctor?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe. Could be. I don't know. No, I think I just thought it was icky to have you know, people bleed on you and things like that. Here's the thing. Doctors were civilians. I was in the arts. I was in show business. And that was my life. That was my identity. I didn't want to do anything else. And when people ask me for advice, young people who want to be actors or writers, especially if they want to be actors, I say to them, if there's anything else you can do, you should do it. If there's any hint that you can do something else, don't waste your life trying to be in show business, because you have to have an all-consuming need to do it, an all-consuming passion. And I did have that. There was nothing else that I would consider being.
Alan Alda, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alan Alda, speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. Next week, he'll be featured in TV's The West Wing, playing a senator running for president. Later this month, he also portrays a senator in the new Martin Scorsese film, The Aviator, about Howard Hughes.